Welcome to episode 56 of the One Last Sketch podcast, a show about how science fiction and fantasy influence and reflect the world around us. I'm Michael.
I'm Marie.
And I'm Corey.
We're continuing our 2024 book club with my pick, The Annual Migration of Clouds by Premi Mohammed, published in 2021 by ECW Press.
I'm just going to come straight out and say I really enjoyed this one. That will probably be obvious by me gushing over it.
So, a complete turnaround from our last episode.
Yes.
Can't stop, won't stop. One last sketch podcast.
Our book club is a rotating thing where we each pick a book over the course of the year for everyone else to read. This is our second ECW Press book. ECW Press is a independent Canadian publisher. They've been around a long time. More recently, they've started publishing way more science fiction and fantasy than we see from them. Woo! And in terms of the Canadian science fiction scene, I think they're doing a great job. Mm-hmm. And just to tip my hand the same way that Corey did, I think this book demonstrates that. Mm-hmm. The fact that they published this really shows that they're putting out some great work. So this is my pick. Why did I pick this book? Well, there's two main reasons. Number one, I just think this is the best piece of specifically Canadian science fiction that I have ever read. I've thought about that for a while, and I'm pretty comfortable saying that. By specifically Canadian, I mean it's written by a Canadian, and it's set in Canada. I didn't hear all that much buzz about it, and I think it really deserves a lot more recognition. This podcast may have a tiny audience, but I really wanted to push it out to everybody that I could. Reason number two, I think will be obvious if you've listened to previous episodes. This book is set in Alberta in the near future, specifically the University of Alberta. And I think that's the point where we go into our origin story, which is that's where we met. Yeah, where this book takes place.
Yeah, we literally all met in university.
Yeah. Yep, at that university, in that city, in those places.
I will say there are references to the BioSci building, which are not nearly as funny if you haven't physically been in it.
The in-jokes are good. I will say, of the two books that we've read that are like based in the University of Alberta, this is the much better one.
To jog people's memory, we did talk about at one point, what was it called?
The Next Margaret.
Oh, I sat that one out.
Yes, you did. Which I am still fond of. Still fond of, but this one, now I can be like, oh, this one has captures the place feeling that book has. And is also otherwise a really great book. So there you go.
Yeah, so previously we've also talked about our suitability to talk about the books that we've picked for this book club. And in this case, I think our suitability is very high.
Yep. We've been in those buildings. And, I mean, maybe I'm the most suitable for the BioSci complex as one, having had to go around there the most compared to either of you, having achieved a bachelor's in biological sciences from the University of Alberta. And, like, I feel like you don't really get BioSci until you've tried to go to the little cafe that is on one of the, I think it's the fourth floor, it's been a long time since I've gone there, and you have to, like, wind through some areas of it. And then some parts would have open buzzing machinery that are very alarming. And go past a sign that says, no lab coats here. And then you get into actually a nice view of the river valley. And there's a little cafeteria there, and it's bizarre.
So, for context on what BioSci specifically is like, Marie took me, lowly arts major that I was, on a tour through there one time. We started this tour by walking up a staircase. We looped through the building, did a bunch of stuff, we went up another staircase, and ended back where we started.
It is truly
an... It makes no sense.
It's really an M.C. Escher building. There's a good story about... Like, there's probably a truth about how it was built that then goes into the myth of how BioSci, I think, is built. which, as far as I understand it, multiple contractors not really agreeing with each other. Buildings that sort of fuse into this sort of vaguely dog-shaped shape, if you looked at it from the top. Very 70s build. There's all the stories about, like, the rooms you can't actually get into because they've been walled off, and the closet that has a sink inside of it, and the rooms that are accessible through other rooms. Like, it's just haywire. It's impossible to find anything in there. And that's where a lot of the, I don't know if they are now, but they were when we went through all those decades ago, where you'd have a lot of your first year labs for a lot of science labs, mean like biology and ecology and other stuff, but you'd have to go and find your lab somewhere in the bowels of this building, and it was never easy. And heaven forbid if you had the lab lecture associated, you also had to go find that somewhere in another hallway.
So before we alienate our audience completely, going off on a tangent that seems completely unrelated to what we're talking about. Yes, a big portion of this book takes place in that specific building. We are not just suddenly reminiscing about
one
random bits of architecture at the University of Alberta. The Annual Migration of Clouds is a short little book. There's a lot of talk, especially if you're in the Hugo Awards categorizing, like, this is a novel, this is a novelette, this is a novella. I'm just going to call this a book. It's a little bit more than 150 pages. You can read it in an afternoon. You might want to soak it up a bit more, which I think is the more recommended way to read it.
Yeah, I found it's weird because this was not like a page turner for me. This was not like, oh my God, I must keep reading. But it was really good. Like, it was the kind of book you want to savor, and that it's very much written in a way to savor.
Yeah, I was savoring it, enjoying that. And then I had to sit in the emergency room for a really long period of time waiting to get a rabies vaccine, and I finished the second half. Maybe not a great topic, actually, if you're worried about organisms inside of you that can mean you harm. But anyway, yeah, I'd say it is actually something that I was generally putting down, not because I wasn't enjoying it, but because you kind of become aware how quickly you're getting through something. You're like, oh, but it's good.
And that brings us a bit into what this book is about. It's the near future, maybe the far future. It's far enough that, or near enough that people can remember civilization before the climate collapse, but climate change has got its course. The wealthy people have all walled themselves up in domed cities and left everybody else to rot. They are just starting to send their feelers out to the rest of the world now, the world that they left behind. That's where this novel takes place, on the grounds of the campus of the University of Alberta, which has now become a small community where those remnants of people live who are around in Edmonton. Our main character, Reed, gets a letter saying she's accepted to one of the universities in these dome cities. And you think that the novel is going to be about Reed's adventure trip across blasted post-apocalyptic Alberta, Canada, as she makes her way to the university. And no, that is not what the book is about. It's instead about the 3 days where Reed is making her decision whether to leave her community or not. On top of this, Reed is infected with a fungus that is called CAD. You get this. It is a hereditary infection, so you get this if your parents had it. Its effects vary wildly depending on the person. Whether it manifests or not, you're not really going to know until it happens. It can affect your behavior and will, but you don't know when that's going to be. And that is part of the struggle that Reed has as she's making the decision that's being put before her. Mm-hmm. So, Corey and Marie, have you any familiarity with Primi Mohammed?
Nope. First one of her books I've read.
Likewise.
So I first was aware of Primi Mohammed because she did an interview on CBC Radio. I think it was on the local Edmonton station because she's an Edmonton author, and they were doing like a best of roundup on CBC that included her segment about like climate fiction. She does have a science background. I read her first book, which is Beneath the Rising, a Lovecraftian science crossover thing that's also starts in Edmonton. I think this is a real case for giving an author another chance. because I did not like Beneath the Rising at all. It was very quippy, which is just not my style. I did not read the rest of that. And really, it was the cover by Veronica Park of The Annual Migration of Clowns that got me to give this author another chance. And boy, am I glad I did.
I mean, yeah, the cover... I mean, Corey and I have this whole magpie thing going on. We don't have to explain the magpie thing. But there's a big magpie on it with some stuff coming out of it. And it's a really cool cover. It's a really well-designed book. So, yes, when we saw that, I was like, I have good feelings about this.
I mean, I feel important context. Marie and I had a magpie on our wedding cake, and we both have magpies tattooed on our bodies.
And this is also like an Edmonton thing, to be clear.
Yeah.
Like, magpies are very charismatic birds, for those of you who don't live in this area. And they're not like Australian magpies or that have a different kind of mode. There's kind of, I don't know, they're kind of like crows, but maybe a little bit more sort of like brash the sense that they'll like kind of go around. And they're very pretty, and they make terrible sounds. Hilarious, terrible sounds. And they're just kind of everywhere. They survive very well in urban environments.
Yeah, so they're in the same family as crows, so they behave in very similar ways. They're very smart birds. They're very colorful and pretty, like Marie said. They're very smart. They're not, again, like not like Australian magpies where they're destructive. They're more playful and tricky as opposed to like overt assholes.
Yeah. Well, I think it's only one time of the year that the Australian ones are like that. And also they're really kind of like a Western Canadian thing. They're not in Ontario. Which is the thing that still makes me the saddest about living in Ontario is the lack of magpies. But yeah, they are all over the U of A campus. I would fully believe in an apocalypse they will still be all over the U of A campus.
Oh yeah, no, they're going to survive climate change, no problem.
Yeah, yeah. They're generalists, they're corvid, they'll do great.
Yeah, so that's the first thing we're going to dive into, which is this future as imagined in this book, which unfortunately sounds very plausible.
Yeah, this is like the parable of the sower, where you're like, oh yeah, yeah.
So, for me, I think this is one of the more believable apocalypses I've ever read in a book, for two reasons. One, the author, as you said, does have a scientific background, and I wouldn't describe this book as hard science fiction, but I would describe it as having enough hard science in it that you can clearly tell the author knows what they're talking about, but that is made to serve the story, not the other way around, which is my big gripe with so-called hard science fiction.
You could probably just say it's, like, scientifically informed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's one part where they're kind of reminiscing on how when the world, quote-unquote, ended, and there's no big cataclysmic event. It's literally the lights went out and they never came back on.
Yeah, it was a really good description of what's likely to happen, which is that things will just sort of slump. And, like, quality of life will be bad for a lot of people. And the variance really is just what's going to happen socially in terms of, like, large group organization. This is a version where things got very local. There doesn't seem to be any kind of, like, larger organization much beyond that. It's, like, definitely just in your, like, little enclave. Which to me is probably very likely when you also don't have the communication systems any longer.
It's like, it's almost like a small city-state kind of thing, where people form communities, those communities trade. One thing I actually really liked about this book is something it lacked, which was there were no, you know, wasteland raiders. That's such a cliche of, you know, post-apocalyptic science fiction, which exists, which is fun, don't get me wrong. I do like stories that do that, but it also feeds into a very specific power fantasy, which this book doesn't. And I think it's taking a very realistic look at what this future could look like.
Yeah, like the way that people are just going to assort and how, like, power and lawmaking sort of takes its form when you got this, like, smaller sort of view and like, ability. And also, people are generally still pretty altruistic. Like, overall, that's the main theme, and that's like the struggle for the character Reed is people care about each other. She cares about her community, and her leaving is of consequence to the community as well. And so that's And even, like, dudes who are big, tough dudes, like the Red Flags or whatever they're called, that are kind of like the...
They're police, basically.
They're, like, police, so they're also, you know, like, fishy in a kind of way. But they're also, like, seems... Like, everyone seems kind of reasonable. Everyone sort of gets, like, roles and how they go. It's like, you didn't get the sense that, like, she couldn't... There's a point where she's walking down what's clearly White Ave, and it's not like she was worried about being, like, molested as she's doing that or anything, because it's, like, still... Like, society still operates.
Well, I think one thing as well that I really love about this is good science fiction, no matter when it's set, talks about the day it's written, not the time it's set in. Mm-hmm. And the book does a great... I think as bleak as parts of the story are, I think that's kind of where the hopeful element of this comes in, is showing that, you know... We can still build communities no matter what. And the true strength of people to survive is in our ability to be social, to form communities, to form attachments, not in our ability to hoard guns and, you know, go on violent rampages. Like, it's a very political book, both in the overt descriptions and in a lot of the subtle details. And that was one of them that, for me, was really nice to see.
Kind of a Canadian thing, because there aren't actually, you're right, there aren't really any guns in this. Maybe because we don't have so many, or they've been used up, like the manufacturing might not be so possible or that kind of stuff at that point.
In this setting, I think they say something like 90% of the world's population of now is gone.
Mm-hmm.
By the time we get to whatever year the annual migration of clouds is supposed to be set in.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to circle back to that point about science fiction commenting about the now, because I think this book in particular is so much about the characters reflecting on the past civilization and what they're trying to build on top of that. Mm-hmm. Because they are in Edmonton, they're in an urban center. It sounds like that's where most of the remaining population has gone to outside of Indigenous people who basically left, it sounds like, those areas.
Yeah, and like, because the whole thing is like, very sad the whole time, because obviously, yeah, people are still surviving. They're not thriving. Life is very hard. It's on a margin. It's like in The Dispossessed, the margin of error you have to travel like over the ice scape, and you have to calculate your fuel and like food and energy expenditure. Like, it's like that kind of margin that they have.
I think you mean The Left Hand of Darkness.
Sorry, The Left Hand of Darkness. Thank you. And all those people did die. Like, they're all gone now. And a lot of animals have died. They are also gone.
And they are very aware of the past, because guess what? If you live on a university campus, there's going to be a lot of books, which they do treasure and is preserved. But they read about things... I read comments about this several times, that you can read about stuff in the books and have a general sense of what life in the past was like, but you have no concept, really, of what they're talking about half the time.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's no electricity, there's no long-range communications, there's no internet, there's nothing like that. And what you're left with in terms of the past is old buildings and heaps and heaps and heaps of garbage. Just garbage.
I mean,
they are using it or trying to use it, but they're always, the past is always weighing on them, because they're just living surrounded by the remnants of a civilization where all they can think is like, how could you build so much and for it to all fall apart and leave us behind?
I mean, I think you could argue that that's true of any age, though, right? Like, we don't live in an era with gas lanterns and, you know, brick buildings everywhere. So, like, for us, reading work by the Victorians or the Edwardians is in some sense no different. But again, going to the comment it's talking about today, it's very much calling out how wasteful the world we live in and the social structure that we've inherited is. And I do actually want to disagree with the point Marie made. She says nobody's thriving. I don't think everyone is thriving by any means, but I do think there are people who are finding ways to thrive. I think that is part of the optimism of the book, of which there is very little, is that the human spirit always continues. And like, there's one part, Reed goes to
The brewery?
Yeah, the brewery. And people are distilling and they're making alcohol. And they're like, yeah, we think we might have finally found a way to make beer. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's like, okay, yeah, is alcohol an essential? No. But just for people to find those moments of joy and discovery and in creation, even if it's something as simple as we've made booze, right? That is a very empowering, uplifting thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I meant just medically. Sorry. I meant the like nutrition is limited. Mm. Like that kind of thing is what I meant. But no, I agree with you that like there's lots of examples of people being creative. Which is always even what's his face? That's the director of Mad Max. Is like even in like the in an apocalypse, people still make art. That's why there's all this like imagery and stuff because that's like an important part of what being human is. Maslow's hierarchy is incorrect. So
yeah, it's like the joke of oh, you know, it's the apocalypse and everyone's got mohawks. It's like yeah, people in every era of our history that we have evidence for, people have always created. And they've always created things that didn't serve any inherently quote-unquote practical need. Mm-hmm. But they've also done that because there is a need beyond the practical there that's being expressed.
Mm-hmm. So if you want to name a pervading emotion that you can feel in this book, I would characterize it as simmering rage on the parts of several characters.
Yeah.
Several times, Reed expresses so much resentment over the world coming to this point and also her own particular circumstances leading her to the choices that she has to make.
So what I kind of love about this book is it's a teenage protagonist who's very adult. Reed lives in a world where she had to grow up very fast, and all of her anger, all of her rage, it's not teen angst. It's very much justified anger. And I think that's, again, the book. Maybe I know this is a risky thing to say, but I think that's the author, you know, expressing her own anger about the damage and the injustice in our world through these destructive acts. And yeah, I think rage is a great description, and I think it's a justified one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one particular segment where Reed is just talking about plastic and how the previous civilization would just make things that you had to throw away right away and get a new one. And now where resources are so scarce, it's like unthinkable.
Mm-hmm. Her and her mother like spin it down into like plastic thread.
Yeah, they have a spinning wheel. Yeah. And that's one of the functions they serve in their community. Is they're the, would spinsters be the right word?
Yeah, kind of.
Yeah, they kind of are spinsters mm-hmm. in a literal sense. Mm-hmm.
And how it's like, well, I'm thankful that they left all this plastic that we can reuse. But because it's so difficult to just make anything now mm-hmm. and to think that you had the industrial capacity to make stuff before and you just ended up making things that had to be disposed of, that's kind of just a greater commentary on a lot of the things happening.
I was gonna say, that's actually a very scathing commentary, and I love it, because we've developed an economic system that thrives on its own continuance. So literally the only way some companies can make money is to make products to be disposable. And yeah, like this is not a book that pulls its punches with what it thinks is wrong with the world, and I love that it does that.
And it's like, it's a great example. I mean, animals are like rare, so, and there's wild pigs now in the Edmonton River Valley, which they go on a boar hunt at one point. And it was so marketed that, like, even the availability of like making a spear that wouldn't suck, or like a bow and arrow, or like just those kind of implements, the challenge like in just having a good construction to do that task. It's like, yeah. And you could have shot things back when you had guns, right? Mm-hmm. Would have been so easy. And now it's really risky.
Yeah, the pig hunt is interesting because I know that in various parts of Canada, wild pigs are actually a nuisance species or like an invasive species. I think, I could be wrong, but I think there were native boars here. But domesticated pigs have escaped and they've, you know, crossbred, and now they cause a lot of ecological damage and agricultural damage. But one thing I do know about boar hunting and pig hunting is that without firearms, it's very difficult. Like, I've read medieval things and descriptions where, from earlier eras, you don't hunt them with a bow and arrow because they're just too tough. You need a spear to take one down. And that requires you to get, like, frighteningly close to a very powerful animal. And, I mean, obviously, there's a lot of, you know, drama and narrative interest that the book gets out of that, which I won't go into in too much detail. But, yeah, it's like living in a world where wild pigs are everywhere is kind of terrifying.
Yeah, and they're kind of singled out, too, as we don't know what they're eating, but somehow they're thriving.
Pigs, man.
I mean, little bit of ecology that I, you know, pigs are generalists. They can pretty much eat anything.
Oh, I fully believe that, like, yeah, you'd have magpies and pigs. I'm like, yeah, that sounds about right for what's going to manage in an apocalypse.
So that, we've laid out kind of the external circumstances of the annual migration of clouds, but there's also an internal one with Reed, which is this CAD, the fungal infection that she has, which she characterizes as a parasite. It could also be symbiotic. It expresses itself in different ways depending on the person. Generally, it tries to stop its host from coming to harm. So it can affect you. And this is also a matter of resentment for Reed, because at any point she feels her body can be taken over by this other force that will push her to do things that she does not want to do or stop her from doing the things that she does. And that really is like an internal expression of her external struggle too, in choosing what to do with this university acceptance that she gets.
Yeah, for me, the CAD is very much a way of kind of internalizing the metaphor. Because again, it's this world that has a lot of horrible things, a lot of resentment for the past. And it's easy to say, oh, you know, you resent what came before you, but it's another thing to feel something beyond your control physically controlling you. And it's equally true that the world you're born into is going to exert physical control over you. But in this case, it's a way of showing what that would literally feel like. You literally have something attached to you that controls your circumstances, controls your body. And that's no less or more harrowing than the world controlling you. I think it's just a little easier to digest and internalize and understand.
It makes the metaphor that most young people in books have, which is around like, oh, the old people are so cautious and they don't want to take risks or do these things. And I think that's just kind of generationally what always happens at different stages of life. Because the CAD, I know Reed characterizes it as it like kind of makes you sort of like docile, or, and she's very sort of sardonic about its effects on people and her desire to sort of rebel against that. And it's not until like an incident near the end where she gets a perspective that it's sort of towards a collectivism. It sort of suggests that maybe like thinking about safety beyond yourself has a value, or there's something that's actually useful about this. And she kind of moves with it, and that sort of releases the tension. It's because instead of like being in opposition, she gets an interest in understanding this more, which you could just sort of read as a perspective taking.
Yes, it's kind of working through all the other issues she has with this external setting inside of her. So she has this resentment against the past civilization. More immediately, she has resentment against her mother, because anybody who has CAD passes it on. There's not a chance that your child won't get it. And CAD will kill you eventually. Mm-hmm. Well, and you just don't know when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's one of the weird things about CAD is that it will kill you, and it will probably kill you in a very gruesome and painful way, but it's random. It's seemingly random. Like, you could be fine for decades, and then all of a sudden, one day, or you could be a teenager, and then all of a sudden, one day, and just, you never know when it's going to hit.
Yeah, some people don't manifest any symptoms at all.
Yeah.
And you just don't know. And it's also very believable how it gets introduced into the population. But because it doesn't manifest immediately, by the time we discover that this thing exists, it's already too late. It's so spread out throughout the already highly depopulated world that it is now intrinsic with being human, that this is something that people have to live with.
Well, and there's a sense that it's like affecting other animal life and things too. Like, you see some it makes some kind of gestures at some parts, so you sort of, it is a fungal kind of thing, so there's kind of like spores. But then there's also that kind of connectedness that funguses have, way beyond human ability, that it sort of makes it intriguing in exactly what it's going. And because it's such a non-human organism, you can't, like, understand or anticipate what its intentions are, because it doesn't have intentions in the same way that humans do.
Yeah, it's kind of implied that maybe it has an agency and an intelligence, but if it does, like Marie said, that's so foreign to our own experience and understanding that we can't really wrap our heads around it.
Yeah, because Reed can resist the behaviors that the cat is inducing, even though it does come at experiencing extreme pain as a result. But Reed also later on comes to be able to communicate with it or to understand that you can work with this thing as well as resisting it to achieve a kind of shared end, which, you know, is also kind of what the whole book is about.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not super fond of this phrasing because it sounds dismissive, but it's like going to the teen angst metaphor. It's like almost embracing your demons. And I mean, by no means is it that simplistic a description or simplistic a thing that's happening, but that's just kind of a good way to conceive it. It's you make peace with all aspects of yourself, and in doing so, you're able to finally move forward.
And there's also, like, I mean, she's been accepted to this university. There's a sense that Cad has been in the population, but, like, the collapse only happened a couple of generations ago. Like, it's not super... It's unclear exactly how long. It's also a little
bit... close enough that there's two people who can remember life during the collapse when they were young. And they're in their 70s, I think.
Yeah, there's two older ladies who remember movies when they were kids.
Yeah, and like you get the sense that the collapse is also very slow and gradual, so there's no particular time. But Cad has only been in the population for a few generations, so the likelihood that somebody's worked with it yet, maybe not. So that might be like her insider discovery. I mean, I'm certainly, by the end of this book, I'm like, I want to read the next one, because I am curious what happens in this story.
The way that the elements work together in this book is very elegant, which is just a wider expression of how I find this book stylistically and in terms of its expression. It's an elegant book. The writing is very, very pleasant to read. It's this very close character study that moves around a small group. It's not sweeping. There's like a real focus, a real intimacy to not only the story, but just how it's written. And it has this cadence that really fits the age of the character, where there's just a lot of parentheticals, I will say.
Yeah.
One thing.
Lots of interruptions, but it's using those interruptions in a very particular way. It's very deliberate about it. Mm-hmm. And I find it works really well. Like you're getting into the rhythm, the pattern of the writing, and then there's an important point. It's suddenly stop. Mm-hmm. Pay attention here.
Yeah, one thing I really like about it, and this kind of goes with the elegance, is that it's a great book at setting up expectations and then not following through on those expectations in very good ways. Because like Michael even said, from the beginning, you expect that this is going to be the story of, you know, Reed going on her little hero's journey across the wasteland. And no, it's not at all. And that's great.
Yeah, it almost feels bad to tell people what the book is actually about. Because so many times it feels like it's going down one pathway that are really well trod in the science fiction genre, and that it just steers away from that and goes, well, did you think about this? And pulls on that thread and goes that direction instead.
Yeah.
And that's really a lot of the pleasure of reading it, is just appending expectations all the time, but not in a way where it's just like, oh, surprise.
Yeah, it's
always in a very thoughtful way.
It's really good at exploring the alternate side of the familiar narrative. Because we get used to narrative patterns. We get so used to narrative patterns that we don't even think, well, what if things had gone another way? And this book very much does. It's like, well, what if they'd gone another way? What if this familiar story unfolded in unfamiliar ways? And I can already kind of see, based on what's been established in this book, what would happen in the next one and possibly a third one after that. And I really hope the trend of frustrating those expectations continues. If what I'm expecting to happen doesn't happen and doesn't happen with equal elegance that this book delivers, it'll be brilliant.
Yeah, I should be clear that Rumi Mohammed has said several times that this was not meant to be a series. Mm-hmm. This was meant to be a standalone, and it just happens to be a series now. That was only announced this year that we're getting more books.
Oh, is that a publisher interference? Oh dear, maybe it won't be good.
Possibly. But, you know, I'm glad to actually hear that, though, because this works beautifully as a standalone.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, there are so many stories between stories, and where one story begins, another story ends, and this is very much ending at the beginning of another story. And I think in some ways that's probably part of the metaphor as well, in that things always continue. You know, climate collapse might happen, but wildlife will continue, community in some form will continue. And I think as bleak as this book is at times, it does have weirdly, like, large amounts of optimism.
Mm-hmm.
I also think it just chooses, it has a very well-chosen span of time and focus to it for what it's trying to achieve, because there are many ways where you could broaden out this narrative, and Rumi Mohammed never does that. It's always going to keep that laser focus on just, it's just these few days.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to encapsulate every theme that I want to cover in this very constrained time period, in a very constrained format of a book.
Mm-hmm.
Like keeping it so short and just having every word matter. So I wanted to move on from that to the character relationships in this, which are also, you know, when I said all the elements work together, character relationships are deeply intertwined with these larger themes of agency and helplessness that are throughout this book. Because we have particularly the relationship between Reed and her childhood friend Henrik, which gets pretty fraught at times, and also Reed and Claire, her mother, which also gets very, very fraught as the story continues. The juxtaposition of Henrik and Reed is kind of a perfect encapsulation of a lot of this, because while Reed is courageous and is, she has to struggle against Cad, which is stopping her from realizing her full potential. And Henrik is in many ways the opposite, that he doesn't have Cad, but maybe he doesn't have the innate qualities that Reed does. But on the other hand, you can see why they're friends. Mm-hmm. And even though terrible things happen that really fray the edges of their relationship later on, they do come to realize what they are to each other by the end. And in a lot of books with characters of this age, that kind of fraying would have just resulted in, well, just ditch this person. And it's not that simple here.
And also it's like, there aren't a lot of people. Like,
yeah.
Ditch him for who? is kind of the thing. So you sort of have to work situations out, even though she's considering leaving. Like, she doesn't want to have this relationship be sour, but also, like, resents, like, is like, pushed by Henrik to, like, go and achieve the thing, but also, I think, resents his kind of weaknesses, because he has quite a few.
Sorry, he's interesting, because he does have some personal weaknesses, but he's not... he's not just a sidekick character who's devoid of any agency, who only exists to frustrate. Like, he is in many ways more sensitive than Reed. He is in many ways kind of the soft counterpart, where she's the one who has, like, a lot of power and agency that is being frustrated. And he actually does too, just in different ways, and in ways that this world very much doesn't, at best, doesn't reward, and at worst actively punishes. Even though they're no less valid expressions of, you know, being a person. And again, like, this is not a book that does things accidentally. So I do think that that is a conscious choice. And that, for me, he is more of a tragic figure than anything. Because he wants to be strong, he wants to be brave. Basically, he wants to be more like Reed. And he can't be, and that does cause him trouble.
This is where the depopulation in this book really helps it because the setting affords a level of richness to these character relationships that maybe you wouldn't get in a book of this length if there were more people around. I know that seems obvious to say, but it has very richly developed character relationships, and there aren't many of them, but what's there is explored to an extremely deep level,
Well,
and
it's a
I really
very
enjoyed it.
intimate book, right? It gives you a very intimate view of one person and what it bought character study, and it gives you a very intimate view of their relationships. And those relationships, by necessity, are all not physically intimate, but have a very strong closeness to them.
It's because Henrik's thing that makes him interesting is he does a gesture to try. It's clear that he views Reed's journey as more important than a lot of other things. He does a gesture to try to like have that happen, and she sees through this thing later on. But it's in this kind of like even sort of the weakest person is like lending strength to something, right? Because there's as much as she's struggling with, like, can I leave people? Like, this is like a permission and encouragement to do that, in a way. And, I mean, he's also does things that are really problematic and really bad. And a lot of you hear, like, from like other people in the cohort that would like to see him come to some harm or face consequences for things that he does. But there's still kind of like a he deserves space, just like how this little kitty deserves some space, right, Jane? Well, now she won't make sound.
That covers the personal relationships, and I wanted to come back to the setting because this also speaks to the choice to set this book and make the story about the central struggle of the story being whether Reed will leave or not in these few days where she's making this choice. It's because it really explores this community that's sprung up on the University of Alberta campus and what it means for Reed to leave. Not only these people behind, but to have this sort of intentional community that they've set up where every person is important to the functioning of the entire community. And this is really in contrast to so many post-apocalyptic stories where it's everyone for themselves.
I mean, for me, I think a lot what a lot of that is that Reed is very much aware of the fact that no individual is more important than the community, but the book is also aware of the fact that the individual can't be expected to suffer for the community. It is a book with an understanding of the necessity of balance and maybe kind of looking at what balance could entail.
Yeah, I'd say individuals do suffer because there's a pretty clear like need to toe the line or you're out because it's very important, right? This is a community on the edge, so it's not tolerating a lot of variance. And I think that it's like, but if you're just sort of stuck and trapped in your function, like you might wish for more freedom of will, and that's I think kind of was in her like letter or her thing that she originally drafted. To get into that was her submission into the university. Like that's kind of the issue because like it's not like this community is perfect or anything. It's an accurate kind of picture of what it would be like to have to try to regulate such a like difficult thing. Even though it's sort of diffused, like it's communal, but it's not like there's a king or a mayor or somebody. It's sort of done in a group, but because everyone sort of understands their role, and I mean we have this there's an example of justice being carried out for people who don't respect that kind of thing, and it's pretty extreme. So
It's capital punishment.
yeah.
I will come to another part of our enjoyment of this book, which we've been really trying to push this for other people, but in the end, it also comes down to personal connections.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, like we said at the beginning, we met at the University of Alberta. We all have close ties to Alberta. And I just wanted to get into what it feels like to see this as a setting. To have some place that we spent 4 years of our lives in be the close setting of a science fiction novel like this, where it's obviously very changed from what we experienced. And there is that level of defamiliarization,
And it's in.
but it has that much more impact.
And Corey and I were actually just back on the campus last summer for our anniversary. We chose to go there to like check out what's like. And you know, they haven't improved the carpet in the humanities building, and I don't think they will before the climate collapses. So that'll probably still be there too. So.
One thing for me that was great about this is a lot of books we've talked about, the issues with canned lit before. Our Brown Girl in the Ring podcast goes into more detail on that. But I find a lot of books set in Canada try to shoehorn that fact in such an aggressive, like, obnoxious way. It's like, oh, look, this is Edmonton. You should care about Edmonton. And you shouldn't care about a place just because the story is trying to shoehorn and demand that it's important. You should care about a place because the book shows you why it matters and what life and what's different about that place. And this book does the latter very well. At no point is it, oh, Edmonton's great, care about Edmonton. It's like, well, no, this is our corner of the world, and this is the existence we're facing.
I do love the metaphor that everyone gets an office in BioPsy. It's basically what happens. And there's a sort of a limitation of how many you could have in there, but also that everyone sort of fits into that space. And obviously, like, it's fun to sort of be like, oh, I know what building that is. I know what location the giant market thing is in. I've been on the quads. Like, that's cool. And then it's also it does make it spookier because it's like, and this is what that's being used for. Because it's like, it's not a place of higher learning. This is just a place of survival now.
I don't think you need to be like us and have lived in Edmonton for any portion of time to get into this book. Absolutely not.
No,
No, it's not like it's saying, and now we're in cab, or anything. She actually, there's plenty of parts where I'm like, I'm not totally sure which part that is, but I'm familiar with the setting enough to guess it. But you wouldn't need that. It just makes it richer for me personally, probably.
I can go and read goes into that ruined church and be like, hey, I used to walk by that church every time I would walk to the university in the morning.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's not an experience everyone's going to share, but I don't think that's intrinsic to you having fun with this book.
Yeah.
No, I agree with that. And I think, again, that's one of the strengths about it, because so many books that try to shoehorn Canadiana in there do it in a sense of, like, they're almost trying to be like tourism brochures of, look how great this place is, and if you come here, you can see this thing. This doesn't do that. And it works so much better because of that.
Like, I think it's just a very strong example of how, like, communities live in a place. So there's a strong description of the place that this community is in and how that shapes what they're like. And it's just, I think that it just happens to be the place that she's familiar with so that she can get the thickest description of it that possible.
That all being said, I do think it's important that this book is set in Alberta. I do think the simmering rage the characters feel is expressing a simmering rage Rimi Mohammed is expressing towards her home province.
No, for sure.
Maybe we relate because every time I hear anything of coming out about stuff going on in Alberta, I think I feel that.
So,
Like we talked about ducks on a previous episode by Kate Beaton, and this whole centrality of resource extraction to Canada and in particular Alberta. And, annual migration of clouds is kind of a sequel.
For context, Alberta has a long history of conservative governments, both economically and socially. And the province for a long time has been in this weird mentality that everything is about oil, and anything that even questions oil is a threat to Alberta and the Albertan way of life, whatever the hell that's supposed to be, and is wrong. And the reality is that that oil is very much contributing to the ongoing and worsening climate crisis. And I love how this book is not afraid to call that out.
Yeah, because it's basically saying at the time, you saw where this was going, and you didn't do anything to change it. And it's not like we know who are these this future group living on this desolate campus are going to thank you for that. We're going to be angry about that. And it's like, that's a good reflection to have about your current actions.
And that's why I'd call the annual Migration of Clouds a specifically Canadian piece of science fiction. This is also regional literature, like we talked about in the last book. It is regional to Alberta. It still talks about important issues to the rest of the world, and it's just kind of this slice of what's happening in this particular region and how it applies to just how everything's slowly circling around a toilet right now.
I think one thing this definitely does better is showing how the impact of the local, though. Yes, the local is important, but nothing exists in isolation. And while the book is very much constrained to a small area geographically, it talks about things that have far-reaching consequences. You're never really sure what caused the collapse in the book. Like, was that exclusively from local factors? Was it from things that occurred elsewhere? Was it a combination of both? And I think that's an important thing to consider and remember as we're facing a climate crisis, is that yes, a lot of the things that are causing this trouble do happen in other places, but a lot of things that contribute to it also happen locally. And while you can't fix the problem just by fixing the local, you also can't fix the problem without doing so.
So unfortunately, that means we have to dive briefly into the question of genre here. Because I've been talking about it as Canadian science fiction this whole time. It's also climate fiction, I think, clearly. Which is has been brought out as a subgenre from the last few decades. The back cover copy of the annual Migration of Clouds calls it hope punk. Not a term I'm very fond of. But I'd like to discuss with you two what, just hearing that word hope punk, what does that really mean?
I think it's a stupid term.
Oh my god. I only just noticed this, now that you've mentioned it.
I think trying to classify genre to, like, genre's become this obsessive thing for a lot of people, where it's got to be classified down to, like, the nth adjective of, like, how specific it is. And what all of that misses and forgets is that cyberpunk, like, the original punk genre, was not just an aesthetic movement. It was a literary movement in its own right. And all of these things that people have tried to describe as some new kind of punk or some new kind of this or some kind of genre, they're not literary movements. Broadly speaking, they are working within the science fiction literary movement, but it's not like they're subsets of some other literary movement within that. And the subdivision is inane and pointless and annoying and a bunch of other words that I'm not going to get into because I don't want us getting slapped with an age restriction.
Who's going to age restrict a podcast?
I don't know, but I want to cover all of our bases.
It doesn't make any sense. I'm just going to say, hope punks to me seems like a contradiction from what punk is. Maybe, and it may just be that we're old now, but that's fine. I'd agree, though, about this whole kind of, like, you miss when you're trying to get really tight terminology about anything. You see this in heavy metal. I would even say you'd see it in some, like, personal identity descriptors that people are forming these days. When you get so fine-grained and individual, then you're losing the point that even this very book is making, is the relations with other things, the broader part in which it fits. So I would resist hope punk because I don't think that makes sense as a term. Like, I know what it's gesturing at, but I don't think we want to get too much into, like, saying phrases that are gesturing at phrases, because that's, like, an academic way of going about things, and this is, I think, something that's very broadly applicable and not just niche. It's post-apocalyptic, it's science fiction, it's about climate, it has some regional stuff to it, but I mean, I don't know that you need to go into that deep kind of like setting it in somewhere.
I would also like to say about the term hope punk, it kind of misses the point. Cyberpunk again, is the original quote-unquote punk genre for sci-fi, it was bleak and it was depressing to make a point. It's angry to hold those in power accountable. You can't be hopefully bleak. That doesn't make sense.
Well, and I get it. It's this kind of juxtaposition, maybe. But if I just think about punk, what the punk movement is, this isn't that. It's like how just, like, anything that happens is now, like, a gate after Watergate.
Mm.
There's Gamergate, there's Pizzagate, there's all these, like, everything's a gate because we just keep sort of applying terms. And I don't know. I think that's just, we're probably just getting, like, overly excited about a semantic point here. But I don't think it's actually, that is the kind of thing that I think is the problem that is creating this problem, is the lack of like, broader thinking. When we just have to go and discriminate on this degree.
I mean,
to be fair to whoever wrote the back matter here, they just had to fill a friggin' paragraph and put it there.
I mean, specificity is important, but specificity to the point where you're actually achieving the opposite result is kind of pointless.
So there's my only black mark against the book, the back cover copy.
Yeah, whatever editor maybe wrote that. But that also might just be something that we're, easily, we could just be kind of miffed about something, and people could be like, no, Hope Punk has a meaning with blah, blah, blah. And maybe in a decade, I'll be like, yeah, sure, it's fine. Right now, I'm just like, I'm very annoyed about genre discussions overall in a lot of things. Because I think you're missing the forest for the trees in that one.
I think a lot of genre is a very cynical attempt by the business side of publishing to extract as much money as possible. We need to create this, like, hyper-specific genre, and then in doing so, create a hyper-specific audience that we can market obscenely to suck as much money out of it. That's what it feels like to me. Whether or not that's the reality, I don't know. But I kind of get that flavor from it, and that really bothers me.
I get that. I think you're kind of right. And people, like, you see it a lot in nerd spaces, like, people who highly place their identities with, like, marketing labels of, like, large corporations. And so I'm against things that are so, that can't be diffuse a bit more so, just because I'm like, an individual person isn't the same person in their entire life, and you change quite a lot. And if you have this sort of constant discrimination, then you're not even giving yourself any room to breathe, I'd say.
Yeah.
But that's really not to do much with this book, as just a kind of a consideration on a particular thing people are kind of doing these days, which they've kind of always done, but we're seeing it expressed more, maybe because we have certain forms of communication now. I don't know.
So that brings us to the end of our discussion of the annual Migration of Clouds.
It's a great book!
It is a great book. This is one of the best books I've read in quite a while. I thoroughly enjoyed it. Track a copy down no matter where you live in the world. There is something that will speak to you.
Yeah.
Yep, this was probably my favorite book that I read last year. As I made this grandiose claim at the beginning of the episode, the best book, the best specific piece of Canadian science fiction.
I think that's accurate.
I don't even remember what I said.
Yeah, I can think of, like, good, even great science fiction written by Canadians. This is probably one of the best I've read where it specifically focuses in some way on Canada.
Yeah, the best piece of specifically Canadian science fiction. There we go. I will stand by that. I can't think of other examples. This was great. That's why I chose it. Didn't get that much buzz when it came out. I think it really deserves a lot more attention, not only in Canada, but anywhere. There will be more. There are two more of these coming out, I think. I know that a sequel is coming out this year, which I'm very much looking forward to. Primi Mohammed's actually pumping out quite a bit of work this year. Mostly in this short novel novella space, she seems to be doing really well in.
And it's very refreshing. You know, those of us, like, we just did our Priory of the Orange Tree recording. Nice to have things that are small, too, and specific.
I mean, quality versus quantity.
Yeah.
I would rather have really good books like this that are short than crap that's like 2,000 pages.
And I would just want to say for the listeners out there who are discerning, I'm aware we just bitched about things being hyper-specific, and now we're talking about specificity. No, we are not saying a contradictory statement. Because you can still have some, like, ability to be specific about something without tying yourself into a knot over exactitude at all times.
Exactitude.
Exactitude.
Eh? That's a word now.
Yeah.
So I'll yell it out from the rooftops. People, read The Annual Migration of Clouds. Honestly, this is a fantastic book.
Really good. Really
I loved
good.
It. I think a lot of people will love it too. It just needs a little bit more of a push.
Absolutely.
So that's the end of my pick. Corey, you're next. What are we reading next?
We are reading Roger Zelazny's A Rose for Ecclesiastes.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Excellent. Like the short story.
Yep.
Wonderful.
So we went from a novel to what many would call a novella. And next we're doing a novelette because Corey just had to one-up me.
In my defense, it wasn't a conscious effort to one-up you. I've just been wanting us to cover it forever, and I finally had a chance to.
You know what? It's a perfectly good reason. What's great about that is we'll all be able to read that fairly quickly, but knowing us, we won't for a while. I've read that before, so I think we'll probably all just reread it.
I have not read it before.
Oh, you haven't? Oh, you'll like it. It's good.
It is one of his stronger works, for sure.
Yeah. Wait, is there a version that should be read? Is there, like, more than one version of that one?
As far as I'm aware, there's only one version. It may have been expanded into a novel, but the most well-known, most easy-to-find version is the short story.
Okay.
Or novella, or novelette, or whatever you want to call it.
Okay, yeah. All right. Look at us carrying on. Maybe, like... Actually, no, we haven't really done anything huge for any of these. Probably the Terraformers was the longest one we read. Yeah. Yeah, no, we generally have stuck to reasonable size books, actually, for the
For the book club?
Yeah.
Parable of the Sower.
Was that longer?
That's longer than the Terraformers, yeah.
Is it? I feel like the Terraformers font was... Anyway.
Anyway, this is probably all getting cut anyway.
Anyway, we should do our closers.
Yep. Thank you for listening. You can find previous episodes of the One Last Sketch podcast on my website, onelastsketch.wordpress.com. It's available through an RSS feed, so any podcatcher should be able to find it. Our theme song is Dragon Tales by Butterfly Tea. Our episodes are hosted on archive.org.
And you can't find me really anywhere, because I have cleaned out that blog. Yatropexy is no more. I kept the one thing on the Satanic Panic, because we did that in 2015 before it was cool. And there is no other place you can find me. Shrinkandexpand.com is still there, but... might not keep it. So there you go.
And I don't really maintain an internet presence.
Probably for the best, considering I think I have been over the past year just cutting out bits and pieces of my online life and go, I don't need that anymore. The podcast is all that remains.
Yes. Thank you for listening.
Yep. Till next time, read the Zelazny thing and join us for our next episode. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
We're continuing our 2024 book club with my pick, The Annual Rigration.
Rigration.